Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. I'm Alok Jha. Earphones comfortably on, mind at calm. Right then. On this week's show, what to do if you find yourself facing Armageddon? Disaster expert Bill Maguire's here to give us a guiding hand. We go hunting for bats under Big Ben in London. And one of the very first pioneers of the internet tells us how this thing we call the web came about. Plus, meat from cloned cows, yet another global warming controversy, and a celebrity addition to the club of science PhD students. This can only be Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. After a few weeks of pod emptiness, there's a plethora of science and tech nerds here today. Dr. James Angry Randerson, more than a month away. How does it feel to be back in this luxurious pod, James?
Oh, it's good. It's good. It's been too long.
Your beard is particularly excellent. Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's arts blog is back from giving a cake baking masterclass somewhere on the high seas. Nell?
Yo-ho, my hearties.
Bobby Johnson, the one true pod man. Hello.
Well, hello.
Okay, so let's get on with this travelling circus. The people of Northern England might have been forgiven last week for thinking they were facing a mini Armageddon. Several months of rain poured down in just a few days, roads turned into rivers, and hundreds were displaced from their homes. It could be much worse, of course. Hurricane Katrina killed thousands in the US in 2005, and the infamous tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004 killed a quarter of a million people. Now, Bill Maguire of the Hazard Research Centre at University College London has made it his job to study these cataclysmic events, and he's written a guide on what humans can do about them. He's here in the studio now. Bill, thank you so much for joining us. Can I ask you, does it get depressing reading about disasters all the time?
I don't think it does, actually. People love reading about disasters. In fact, my last two books were A Guide to the End of the World, Everything You Never Wanted to Know, and the current one, which is Surviving Armageddon, Solutions for a Threatened Planet. Well, the second one, which is more optimistic, hasn't sold anywhere near as well as the first one.
Somebody once said to me,
you know, people like to read all about disaster. They're not too bothered about what you can do about them. They just love reading about
them. There's a bit in your book where you do say, and I quote this, I shall stop here before the urge to head for the bathroom and open my veins becomes too strong. That doesn't sound very optimistic to me. But what are the biggest threats facing us?
Well, I mean... there are these things I call global geophysical events, or GGs, GGEs, and we're talking about things like volcanic super eruptions, asteroid impacts, giant tsunamis, all this sort of thing. And these have happened throughout Earth history. They're not going to stop happening because we've arrived on the scene. But clearly, climate change, driven by human activities, is the great global geophysical event. If we don't sort that out, we won't be in a position to solve any of the others when they hit us.
We'll come back to climate change in a minute, but as you said, your first book was about a list of things of what could destroy the Earth, and the latest one's about how to solve some of those problems. But how do you defend against something like an earthquake or an asteroid strike? Tell us how your book's optimistic about that sort of thing.
Well, I'm only slightly optimistic, not very optimistic. But in fact, one of the what appears to be the greatest hazard, asteroids, are probably the easiest to cope with. Because we're
not sure I believe you. But
we already have the technology to get spacecraft out into space and give one of these things a nudge. It only takes about 7 minutes for the Earth to move its diameter in space. If we can spot an asteroid coming our way years in advance, stick a rocket motor on with the thrust of something like a Reliant Robin, if that chunders away for about a month, it will move it. It will speed up the asteroid or slow it down enough so that it'll miss. So we don't need any great technology. There are already plans to do something like this with an asteroid that's going to come close in 2029, which I don't think is a very good idea, because if you want to try out nudging techniques, it's probably best to try them out on an asteroid that's a long, long way away, not one that's going to come very close.
I'm just thinking about the potential lawsuits if you get it wrong and it does hit. Well, someone's
forget
gonna
about
pay.
The lawsuits. There won't be any lawyers. Well,
that's a good point.
There is no protocol either for who to go to if you find out that an asteroid is heading our way. And this actually arose, a situation a few years ago in the US.
In your book, yeah.
And also, who decides when to try and divert one of these things?
It'd be good to recount those events, actually, because that was quite an interesting bit.
It was an asteroid that was spotted by the people that observed these things, the Minor Planet Center or whatever, just a few years ago now. I'm not sure if it was 2004 or not, but this object was spotted. It was thought that it could hit within 2 days, and there was general panic for about 9 hours as they tried to get another sighting of this object to sort of constrain its orbit a bit better. And it was cloudy around all the telescopes that could actually potentially see this thing, so they couldn't get any new data. Eventually, they did get some new data, and they realised it was going to miss by 12 million kilometres. That's how exact the science is. But during that time, you know, they were seriously thinking, should we call the president, this sort of stuff. So.
Well, let's move to more earthly matters. What about earthquakes? I mean, earthquakes can have all sorts of devastating impacts, as we know. The tsunami in 2004 was caused initially by an earthquake in the Indian Ocean. Is it a case of predicting them better so that we can just avoid the worst consequences, or can we actually do something to stop them happening in the first place?
Well, we can't predict earthquakes at all. Some groups say they have or they can, but in terms of being able to say in 3 weeks' time on a Tuesday there's going to be a magnitude 8 earthquake here, that's impossible. We can get some idea of when the next one may occur on a particular fault by looking at return periods, you know, how frequently they happen. All we can do, though, we can't move whole cities away from high seismic risk zones. We just need to build properly. California has tremendous building codes, and you've had major earthquakes there in the last decade or so, which have killed 50 or 60 people in each case. If those earthquakes had happened somewhere else, you'd be talking 20, 30, 40,000 dead. So you have to build for safety. You don't really want to be able to predict an earthquake, because imagine you could predict an earthquake in Los Angeles in a month's time, no, say 6 months' time. It would devastate the economy. Everybody would leave. You'd have a situation as you had in New Orleans with nobody there in the city, the whole place derelict. If you built everything so it stood up, you don't need to predict them. You just have the earthquake happening. Buildings stay up. Hardly anybody dies. But we can predict volcanic eruptions, because magma needs to make space for itself, so it swells the ground surface, and we can detect that. And it needs to break rock to get the surface to make fractures, and we can detect that through seismographs. So no volcano ever erupts without warning signs.
And we're very familiar with the idea of climate change making storms and hurricanes and that kind of thing worse. But do they make any of these other major geophysical events worse? Volcanoes, earthquakes, that kind of thing? I mean, is there any link?
Well, this is really quite a new area of the science, and it's an area we're working on at the moment, how the Earth's crust beneath our feet might respond to changing climate. And if we look back in the past, we see that when the Earth's warmed and sea levels have risen very dramatically, that extra seawater has loaded the crust. It's pressed down on the crust. It's caused bending along the margins of the continents and in volcanic areas, seismic areas. And that's triggered volcanic eruptions. It's triggered an increase in earthquake activity. Those, of course, submarine landslides, they've caused tsunamis. So we can expect, if we see catastrophic failure of the ice caps, Greenland particularly, that we might see a big increase in geological activity.
So is it all going to just get much worse? Because of...
Yes, it is, actually. Yes.
That's not a very good message.
I do not see us having any chance of avoiding dangerous climate change as defined by 2 degrees C temperature rise. I really can't see that happening. So it's going to be bad, whatever happens, but the longer we do nothing, the worse it's going to be.
And on that bombshell, Bill, thank you. We're going to come back to you later on in the show. There's going to be more from Bill on our website, so we'll be posting details on The Guardian's brand spanking new science blog. That's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we go bat hunting in central London, plus the future of the web from one of the men who invented it. But first, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been making headlines for the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
That's right, don't blame it on the sunshine. The notion that global warming is due to natural fluctuations in the sun's activity and not our own carbon dioxide emissions was dealt yet another blow last week. An analysis of solar activity showed a decline since 1985, while global temperatures have continued to increase.
Meat from cloned animals could be on American dinner plates within 2 years, and Europe may not be far behind. Scientists predicted last week that the US Federal Drug Administration may approve the technology for sale to consumers by the end of the year. And they added that there was no evidence that cloned meat posed any risk to human health.
Ice baths to aid the recovery of elite athletes just don't work, according to a study of 40 volunteers. After exercise, the participants immersed their legs in either tepid or iced water. Cold treatment didn't improve their recovery and, in fact, resulted in more pain.
And finally...
Wants to live forever.
Well, rock god Brian May probably thought he would have to live forever to finish a scientific voyage of discovery that he began 30 years ago. But the hirsute Axmeister has finally finished his PhD thesis on zodiacal light. If Imperial College sees fit to award the academic gong, Brian will receive his PhD at a ceremony next May. Brian May. You get it?
And that was your news jam. Thank you, Bobby and Nell. Good to have you both back. Quick question around the pod. Bill, would you eat cloned meat?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure? You must be a cheerleader for science.
I'd have to think about it.
Why?
Probably
what's,
I would.
What would your problem be with it?
Nothing specific. I just like to work these things out for myself.
Nell?
I don't know. I had a look at the risk assessment thing and the rationale sounded perfectly sensible, which is all you're worried about is epigenetic stuff. If the animal can stand up and live and be normal, then it's probably going to be healthy to eat. Fair enough, works for me.
My point would be that surely we pump lots of animals nowadays with antibiotics and growth hormones and stuff anyway, which is probably much worse than just essentially
cloning.
A twin, which is
we're already using artificial insemination.
What about you guys?
I think that's the position I hold, really, is that we eat some pretty weird
pretty weird
stuff already, you know, all of the stuff, all the extra nutrients and everything that are pumped into food already, you know. Actually, if it's a choice between, you know, a healthy natural cloned piece of meat and an unnatural but kind of normally originated piece of meat, I think actually, you know, give me a clone burger any day.
James?
Well, I think that there's something interesting at the bottom of this. I mean, scientists have been saying for years that GM crops are entirely safe. There's no evidence, not a shred of evidence, that they're dangerous to human health. And yet, consumers have, you know, given at least on this side of the Atlantic, have given, you know, an emphatic no. So I think, you know, scientists are going to have to do more with cloned meat than just say the meat is, you know, identical. You can't tell any difference between a cloned animal and, you know, an animal produced normally. So it's not dangerous, and so it's fine for you, so you should eat it.
There's a difference between this and GM food, though, isn't it, Nell?
I was just going to say, I think that the reaction to GM food, I think you're right, but throws up other problems at a higher level about cloning things or genetically modifying them with relation to what kind of variation you have in the population. And that kind of, and the risks that might involve in terms of disease, and so maybe it's useful to have a bit of anti-clone feeling just to push along similar measures in the animal world.
To regulate that sort of thing. James, let me move on to you. Now, we've not heard any of your anger for a while. you've been ill, whatever, but you've got something to be angry about now, haven't you? You want to get angry about solar theory of global warming, don't you?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things to be angry about, but the main thing...
Let's leave your life out of this. Let's just go back to the solar theory of global warming.
Well, the main thing is that this is just so tedious, you know, that it's come up again, that the whole, you know, global warming is caused by solar activity of some kind. Is it sunspots? Is it something to do with the heliosphere growing and shrinking and cosmic rays all connected with that? And an interesting phenomenon, though, that Professor Mike Lockwood has come up with a kind of new analysis of some solar data in direct response to the Great Global Warming Swindle.
The Channel 4 documentary
directed by Martin Durkin. And I think it's interesting that he's written a paper in response to a TV programme. But basically, the paper says solar activity has declined since 1985, and yet the temperatures have continued to rise. So the solar idea, you know, there's no doubt that solar activity does affect climate over a long period of time, but it's not responsible for the global warming that we're seeing now. So, you know, it's yet another nail in that coffin, but it's kind of annoying that it comes up in the media again and perhaps gives the impression to people. I mean, I wrote this story and I tried not to give the impression that at last we've solved the mystery, because actually this mystery had been solved a long time ago.
Bill, as James said, that a lot of this is just a new analysis of the solar data, and it's written in response to a documentary. It is in a peer-reviewed journal, but does it annoy you that this keeps coming up again and again? Should we just move on? Should people just move on with it?
Well, we keep trying to move on with climate change all the time, and have done for, you know, at least 10 years, and it's still presented as if there's an even-handed debate, which is utter nonsense. There's an even-handed debate between almost the entire climate change community and Jeremy Clarkson and the Daily Mail and David Bellamy and one or two others on the other hand. But that is not, you know, an even-handed debate. So, yes, it's incredibly irritating. And even with this story, I understand that the people who were proposing that, the scientists who were proposing that there was a solar effect are saying, ah, maybe there's a lag then. So they just won't give in. You know, maybe they say, ah, the sun does control our temperature, but... that fall hasn't yet been reflected in temperatures.
No.
What amused me was then you get the argument that goes, well, if it's declined over the past 15 years, then maybe we're seeing a worse climate change than we think we are, because once you add back in the sun's effect later on, you get a much worse effect.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the fact that solar activity has been declining, along with the fact, which has been known for a while now, that our atmosphere is gradually probably going to be getting cleaner, both of those... things are suggesting that we're going to get even warmer than we think. So.
James, you've got an interesting coda to this story, haven't you?
So Martin Durkin, the director, wrote to The Guardian and implied that we'd lied in the story by saying that we hadn't given him an opportunity to comment, which is entirely untrue, because I phoned up the Channel 4 press office, who went away, contacted him, talked to him, came back to me and said neither he nor they wanted to comment, which he later admitted in an email. But it was just, I don't know, I wonder if that was somehow indicative of
the programme.
The way it was, the way it all operated. It was a very strange experience.
All right, we'll leave the bit of anger there. But just finally, Bobby, you're an expert on Brian May. He's finished his PhD after 30 years. But my question is, why didn't anyone else sort of complete that bit of work in the meantime? What was it? Was it so boring that no one did it?
Well, I wouldn't possibly comment on that. But I think what has made it interesting again is that what he was looking at is the kind of light you see if you're in the tropics in the morning or the evening. You see this kind of great band of colour and a kind of dusty band of light in the air. Now, you know, that's very interesting. I think in the 70s, you know, they're all a bit... well, you know, interested in the kind of cosmic shapes. You know, maybe there was a bit of that went away. But what they're now seeing is similar kind of bands of dust creating similar effects around other stars. And so that's what's kind of seen the interest resurge and people get interested in it again. And Brian, handily enough, happens to have an attic full of notes that he'd made 30 years ago that he can resurrect. And, you know, all power to him.
That's great. One detail about that story was that all the notes were handwritten. I love that. We'll leave all of that there. Feel free to get in touch if you've got something to add on any of these topics. Details of how to do that, and there are a few coming up at the end of the show. You don't hear much about these fabulous winged mammals, do you? In a bid to reverse that shocking oversight, we sent our reporter Martha Roberts on a bat hunt in the Houses of Parliament in London. Now, Martha, you're here to tell us all about it. Did you have fun?
Yeah, I had a brilliant time, actually, poking around the Houses of Commons with the podcast recorder in hand. And I spoke to Julia Hammer of the Bat Conservation Trust about why we were all there.
Well, we're looking for bats. We've got a bat walk for MPs here tonight. And we've been looking around in the green spaces, in the courtyards, in the Palace of Westminster, because we know there are bats here. We've had records last year. The House of Lords Library had a bat. They rang our helpline at the Bat Conservation Trust to tell us they'd found a bat. And we know that the security guards have seen bats flying around in the courtyards as well. And we're very keen to find records of bats here and across the UK, as we're doing through our National Bat Monitoring Programme.
Sounds fascinating. So why do this around Parliament?
Well, the event was organised by Madeleine Moon MP to raise awareness of wildlife and biodiversity amongst her fellow MPs. And she was very keen to stress that they should realise that wildlife isn't just in the countryside and that it's in the city as well, and even in the Houses of Parliament.
Under the Houses of Parliament as well, and not just in the chamber either. Did you find any bats?
Well, no. They proved a bit elusive, and we were all a little bit disappointed. But luckily for us and the other MPs, the Bat Conservation Trust had brought along a reserve, Sid the Serotine Bat.
This week, not bat hunting, I'm hoping.
No, it's a bit of a strange one, this, but the technology team, as is, have this annual competition, essentially a pub quiz, against MPs to see who knows the most about technology. And this year, the BBC sent a team along as well. Last year we came second and were beaten into second place by John Robertson, who's an MP from Glasgow. But essentially, the reason it's so interesting, and I want to share this with the listeners, is that so we have a pub quiz, blah blah blah. It's talking about technology, lovely. The final round is actually a sing-off between the top two teams. So this week, this year, we had a sing-off between Charles Arthur, who's our technology editor, and Darren Waters, who's the technology editor of the BBC website. And they crooned along to Life on Mars. And you'll be glad to know that our very own Charles absolutely caned Darren in the end. And
do we have this on MP3?
I think there is a copy somewhere. I think one of the BBC guys was maybe recording it. But really, you do not want to listen.
Do you all tip balls? Of course there should be an MP.
That was the winning one. But, you know, we came away with the trophy and showed those parliamentarians where to stick it.
All right, well, fine. That's good. I hope that you didn't disturb the bats. And I just wanted to have my last say on this. And that, as they say, is bat. Now, it's hard to believe that something that now totally dominates how many of us shop, get our news and entertain ourselves was conceived less than two decades ago. The World Wide Web was first dreamed up by two computer scientists at CERN, the particle physics accelerator that spans the border between Switzerland and France. Regular listeners will remember that we've already spoken to the web's most famous creator, Tim Berners-Lee, on a previous show. But the other man in the room in 1989, when those ideas were being batted around, was Robert Caillou. He told James how the web came about.
Like this does not really drop out of the blue sky. It is something that is somehow in the air, and there were quite a few people working on hypertext. Personal computers were everywhere, and the network was everywhere too. At least in academia, the network was everywhere. So there were quite a few people thinking of having some sort of automatic library, and in fact, the file transfer protocol, FTP, which we still use today for downloading, that existed, and the drawback of it was that you needed to know where the document was, you needed to know what computer, you had to have a username and a password to get in there, and then you could download it. So that was not very convenient. And what both Tim and I independently thought of, and we were not the only ones, was to sort of automate that by building these links into the documents and having the computer do the search for you. But we did this totally independently, and it was a common friend who put us in contact, and we wrote together a serious proposal, and that proposal used for the first time the name World Wide Web, which we gave in May 1990, and that was about 5 months before any software was running.
In the introductory material for the Dana Center talk, it says that you had to sort of fight for your concept of the World Wide Web or the form of software that you were developing. Can you explain a bit about that?
Well, yes, it was such a novel idea that it was very difficult to sort of make people understand what it was about. And then on the other hand, there were people in the computing world who did understand what it was about and tried to run off with it and build their own standards, and that would not have worked. So there was a struggle outside to keep people, to convince people that a single standard was necessary and that we needed to have a consortium where everybody would sit around the table and agreements would be made, or else it would just not work.
And just lastly, what should we look out for? What should we be perhaps worried about in the future of the web, and what should we be welcoming with open arms in the future of the web?
We're drifting away from real reality, so to speak, with the advent of all these network games and especially virtual worlds. So lots of people are now going and spending an enormous amount of time in their virtual world and concentrate on the real world only in a sort of second-hand way. And I think that is potentially something that we have to look at.
As ever, thank you all for your comments and emails over the past week. We'll start with a simple one. This is Harry Reeves from Cambridge.
Great job, folks. I reckon it's the best science podcast around currently.
I agree with you, Harry. Then there's this from a listener in Hong Kong who wants to remain anonymous.
I despise The Guardian. I wouldn't wee on it if it was on fire. However, I love The Guardian Science Podcast. Any chance of changing it to The Telegraph Science Podcast? Then I can tell my friends about it. P.S. Could you mention me as a Hong Kong Telegraph reader who listens to The Guardian Science Podcast? Then I can use it in my English class. No names, though.
Not quite sure how to deal with that. Thanks, I suppose. Although you can easily find out his name. He's on our Facebook network. Sorry. Finally, this is from another Harry. This is Harry Sharman from Liverpool.
I have to say that the little song about particle physics was brilliant. Not being a physicist, I don't know how accurate it is, but it sounded very clever and it was very enjoyable. Apart from the rather strange and wholly random beginnings to each podcast, it is a truly great piece of educative journalism. Keep it up, people. P.S. Since it appears that each week the studio team becomes ever more depleted, I'd just like to offer my own services to fill in when you're short of witty intellectual discussion.
Harry, your offer is noted that you might have to fight off Nil. I want to draw everyone's attention, by the way, to the discussion board on our Facebook network, where we're actually taking requests for Johnny B's next song. Well, that's almost it for this week. Bill, before we go, let me ask you one more question. Let's end on a slightly more optimistic note. Your next book is going to be about climate change and what we can do, how that's affecting the world, and then what we can do about it. What can we do about it?
Well, the good news, I suppose, is we can make a big difference as individuals. And I know this is treated as a joke sometimes, you know, buying low-energy light bulbs, etc. But what we need to remember is that everything we do as individuals or as families is multiplied millions and millions of times. So, for example, the average household in the UK has 25 light bulbs. Multiply those by 20 million, convert them all to low energy. That makes a massive impact on our energy consumption.
Okay, well, thanks, Bill. Remember, listeners out there, to check out our new science blog, and you can email us at science@guardian.co.uk if you want to get in touch, or just do the Facebook or MySpace thing. The show's now over. My thanks to our special guest, Bill Maguire, and to our resident chiroptophile, Martha Roberts. And, of course, thanks, as always, to the angry Dr. Randerson, the intrepid Captain Bose, and the mighty Techno Johnson. Science Weekly was produced this week by Francesca Panetta, and I've been Alok Jha.
Guardian Unlimited.